Hello there, and you're very welcome to Burning Books. Joining me today is author Niamh McCabe, an award-winning writer of fiction, non-fiction, poetry, and hybrid prose. Her debut short story collection, Four Night Seas, is published by the Lilliput Press. I began by asking her about her childhood and the books that mattered to her as a young girl.
So I was born in Dublin, and then as a very young child, maybe 3 or 4, we moved to Sligo, northwest Ireland. And then at age 6, we moved to Paris. So a family of 2 adults and 5 children. And then stayed in Paris for 4 years. So spoke French, you know, the French was my kind of my first language and English my second language, just for those years, sort of. And then back to Ireland, back to Sligo, and at 10. And at that point, shortly after that, my father started working in Washington, D.C. So this pilgrimage to the States started happening from the summer of 1976, which was a very interesting summer to go to the States, considering the date. I remember Easter egg rolls on the White House lawn.
Oh, my goodness.
So from the age of 10, visiting the States every Easter and summer. And then I went to college there. So at age 18, I went to art college in Washington. So there was a big tie with Washington and the East Coast of the States in general. And then that brings me right up to adulthood. So that was my childhood.
That was quick. Well, I'm going to bring you right back. Rewind. We're going to go back to this. So you said you moved to Paris at 6 years old. So the first 6 of years of your life were in Ireland. Is that correct?
Yeah.
So that's where I suppose you first learned to. Did you learn to read by 6? Were you reading in English? Were you speaking in English then, obviously?
I was absolutely speaking in English, but I don't remember any books, which is a terrible thing to say, but I don't remember specifically any books. I don't think I'd started school. Maybe I went to Paris at 5, because I don't think I'd started primary school. Maybe I'd done one term of primary school, now that I think about it, in my local tiny little rural school, Denali School, which is now a Sudbury school, which is interesting. Anyway, my schooling started in Paris. Yeah, so I don't remember books. I remember being told loads of stories. I mean, we were mad about fairy tales and the legends and so on. And I remember listening to loads of stories, but I don't remember reading, to be fair, until I went to Paris. I remember beginning to read then there, and stories and books beginning to mean a lot to me.
How did French come into your life then at that point? Do you remember starting to learn French? Do you remember any difference? Do you remember the languages kind of melding or anything like that?
It's so bizarre because, and they say that the language receptor, for want of a better word, in your brain is open at that age. You know, that's the time to learn languages. Because I don't remember ever not speaking French, but obviously I didn't. I went, neither of my parents spoke French and none of us 5 spoke. I'm the middle child, a word of French. And we were just plunked into inner city Paris, straight into an inner city school in Paris. And that was it. It was kind of like, you know, typical Irish parents, certainly of that generation, just get on with it. You know, don't be complaining to us about it. We've got enough on our plate, which they did. So I don't ever remember not speaking. I do remember, I remember a little bit of, you know, small struggles at first trying to get, I remember the one thing I was struggling with was getting the R, you know, going from saying le rat to le rat, you know, and actually a lovely Parisian elderly Parisian woman with her little dash hand, you know, it sounds ridiculous, but it actually happened this way. As I was walking to school one morning and I was practicing my, you know, kiki et a cha, rikiki et a ha, except I was saying it with the stunted R. And she stopped me and she's, no, rikiki et a ha. And she wouldn't let me go till I said it, right? And so that's the only thing I remember about the language. Other than that, I just remember speaking it. And my mother continued speaking English. So we would speak English when we were at home with her and speak French amongst ourselves, the kids. And then sort of half and half with my dad, because my dad was trying to learn French with his job. He needed French. So we used to give him classes at night in French. He'd take us and we would speak French to him for half an hour. That's how he learned. So, yeah, I don't remember any particular challenges with that, which is odd, isn't it?
Yeah, but you're probably right about that. It's the age, isn't it? Like, it's just, you're just kind of, and you didn't register. But yeah, it is weird that you don't remember a specific, or even making out words in French as you were reading. You know, the way you do when you start reading English, you don't remember making out the sounds or learning to read the words in French. So do you remember any French books? Do you remember like what you had at school? Or was there a book from that time that you remember?
I totally do. Like, I remember the... I still have them. They are school books. And this French thing, and it was, again, this was Paris, but there's this appreciation of rural life, certainly in Paris at that time, you know, this is the 70s. This idea of, I remember reading lots of tales about wolves and forests and farmyards with animals that were being attacked by wolves and wild animals, and of course Charles Perrault, the writer, reading his fairy tales, his wonderful fairy tales with Little Red Riding Hood, Cinderella, all of those. I remember reading all of those, being totally fascinated by them, and the versions I was reading were harsh, you know, they were like, they weren't sweet the way I think fairy tales kind of became more sanitized and certainly are now. They were harsh and a little savage, and I loved that. I remember reading Aesop's Fables. All of these were in French. I remember reading Aesop's Fables, and now that I'm thinking about it, all of these things that I'm recounting are all, you know, connected with animals in some way, because obviously with Aesop's Fables, you've got all these wise animals, you know, teaching things to each other, especially the crow and the fox. And then there was a particular set of tales called Les Contes du Chat Perché, which I used to read, and that was about farmyard. So it's the tales of the perched cat. So this cat, it reminds me a bit of the Cheshire Cat in Alice in Wonderland. This cat tells stories about the farmyard, kind of an animal farm thing, but, you know, different things happening on the farm and different dynamics and fights among the animals and the humans that live there. And then the other, actually, probably the highlight of my reading in Paris, when I think about it now, was comics, to be honest, as well as the fairy tales, but comic books, particularly a comic book called Picsou, which was a comic strip on Donald Duck, you know, and all his shenanigans and his nephews, three little nephews. I'm sure that there is the equivalent in English. I'm sure it's not even a French thing at all, but anyway, Picsou and all of his shenanigans. And I really got into comics then. We had Tintin and lots of other, yeah, Picsou. There was other ones other than Picsou, but I can't think of them. Anyway, so French comics, I really got into. The graphic, the illustrations were beautiful.
I suppose this is an obvious question then, is that what sparked your interest in animation? Because I know later on you went to do something in that line, but is that where it began?
To be fair, to be honest, no, it wasn't. I got involved in animation just by pure chance. It was, you know, I returned to Ireland from Washington after graduating. I spent a little bit of time in the States and then I returned to Ireland, not sure what I was going to do. And I just did a course in finished art, animation and graphic design, I think it was called, like a one-year diploma or something, or cert, just to get some kind of employment. And as I was doing that, the Dublin animation scene was just developing. So we had Murakami Wolf and we'd Sullivan Bluth and they were recruiting. And so I just started working for Murakami Wolf on the Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles, as I recall, just by total chance, because those two planets just coincided at that point while I was in Dublin. So, but once I got involved in the animated film industry, all of that love of the comic strip and just the visuals representing the narrative and this kind of sequence, I'm, you know, getting a bit grandiose with my speech there, but that came to the forefront. Yeah, I loved that whole idea, and most especially this idea of, and I think I do use that in my book of short stories, this idea of all these different tracks. So in old-fashioned animation, it's all computerized now for the most part, but in old-fashioned animation, you've got all of these layers that are built up. Physical layers, that's how it works. So you've got your bottom layer, which is your background, your painted background. And for a while I was doing painted backgrounds in animation. And then you've got your underlay, which is another type of background that is painted on acetate that goes over your watercolor background. And that moves slightly, you know, so that's the first thing that slightly moves. So you've got your static background and then you've got this underlay that might move slightly with the action. And then you've got your characters, and each character is on a different plane, if you know what I mean, different dimensions. So they're all animated separately. But when you're looking at the picture, you see them all working together. So you don't see the mechanics behind it. You're not supposed to see the mechanics behind it. So they're all working on these different planes. And then you've got your overlay. There could be several different, you know, overlays of more shrubbery or whatever, you know, furniture, whatever, wherever the scene is. And I was fascinated by that whole concept of all of these worlds operating on these distinct planes to each other, and yet all coming together in the end to form this unified picture. So that sense of animation carried through into my writing.
I was about to say, it's like visualizing your work there, really, in your short stories, very much. Yeah, I love that. Yeah, it describes a novel perfectly as well, doesn't it? In some ways. Were both things always there with you? Like when you went to college before you started work, were you drawn to both visual, like are they separable to you or not? Do you know what I mean? Were you drawn, they're not so...
I'm not at all separate. For me, it's just that creative process. So I was very much, and still am very much drawn to the visual.
Yeah.
But the visual, I suppose writing is so much more specific, and you can get really specific with your ideas and really capture them in a way that visuals don't and shouldn't. I mean, what I love about visuals is that they are so much more open to an extent, and therefore more ambiguous and more, you know, in a way, things that are ineffable can be best contained in the visual for me. But writing, you can be so much more specific. But no, they're not separate. They're just different forms. When I was a visual artist exclusively before I started writing, I used script a lot in my paintings and in my visual work. I would superimpose script, or I would actually look at the script itself, you know, what a word looks like, you know, and play with that visual, or what a letter looks like. And then the art of writing itself. So some of my paintings were just, so there's a performative aspect to it. So I would write something specific over and over again, you know, so over and over again. So you'd end up not being able to see what was written, but you'd sort of recognize maybe some words, or you get a general tone coming out of it. So I suppose this idea of capturing writing, and rather than seeing writing with a beginning, middle, end, it's seen as a whole piece. So that was what the painting, I suppose, was about. So yeah, so script was important, but when I started writing, that's a whole other thing. That's a whole other form. So it's not a neat transition, and neither was it a neat transition in terms of time, going from a visual artist to a writer exclusively. That didn't, you know, it wasn't the natural progression really.
No, and I like how the way we're talking as well is kind of mirroring all this as well, because normally we go, and you did this, and then you went here, and what was the book here, and we're going ping pong, up and down, don't know where we are, it doesn't matter. I really love that sort of semiotic idea of the word and the text and the whole kind of odd mystery of it as well. There is something kind of just totally bonkers about how we've even learned how to write or speak or communicate at all, isn't there? It's just endlessly mysterious. And I think in your work, you know, I've just finished your collection, Four Night Seas, there's a real, you really revel in the beauty of sentences and what words can do. Sorry, that sounds really, it sounds like AI just said that. What words can do, you rattle on what words can do. But you know, there's just, there's so much playfulness with form, and it's absolute joy, just even on the kind of textual level, it's an absolute joy to read. And it's also very visual, surprise, surprise. It's painterly, isn't it? A lot of your stories are very painterly. But for our listeners, we have to get to some books. So I'm going to have to ask you, is there a book you can pluck out of this kind of lovely tapestry of everything that we're talking about? And I'm just going to plump for that quite special time, I think, for a lot of people, which is sort of in their late teens, early 20s, you know, that sort of period where you're, yes, kind of, everything's still fluid. Can you talk to us about a book maybe from that period?
Well, there's one book that I would have started reading as a child and then reread again as a teenager, and then reread again as a young adult. And it, of course, meant something different each time, which I think was the intention of the author. And that is Alice in Wonderland, the Lewis Carroll book. Wonderful, wonderful, very complex and very playful book, which I loved as a child for obvious reasons. And then as a teenager, started, you know, seeing the potential different meanings. And I was fascinated by that, that a book could contain whatever level you wanted to enter into it on, that it was there for you. So if you just wanted to stay on the playful surface level of these, you know, the adventures of Alice, then that was fine. But that it could, if you were willing to go deeper, the book could accommodate that for you. Mm-hmm. I just loved that. So that book meant an awful lot to me. And then, you know, Beckett, I know it sounds a little bit pretentious, but Beckett in a similar way, like I started reading, especially the book, the novel Molloy, but anything by Beckett, I started reading him when I was in art school. So in my early 20s, late teens, early 20s, and was delighted with the way he could also, he's so playful, and the way he could play with words and with just coming up with this nonsense, which was so entertaining, this idea. For instance, the character in Molloy, there's an entire section that Beckett devotes to talking about moving stones from one pocket to the other, you know, the sucking stones, and going into, and I suppose, and this really meant something to me in terms of, as a visual artist at the time, this idea of focusing on this, on the minutiae of this particular character, and embellishing it with beautiful language to make it mean more than it does really on the surface. So having this idea of this like huge world behind this nonsensical, quite futile action of just moving a stone from one pocket to the next, and why he would do that. And I just loved that idea. So that book and all of Beckett's writings were very important to me, because they allowed me not to, that it's okay to deal or to use subject matter and themes that are small and apparently kind of inconsequential, and to go in there. It's almost like, you know, the way macro photography will zoom in on a tiny, you know, like a fly's eye.
Yeah.
So you're zooming in on that, but you're getting it in every beautiful detail. You're getting that little area. And then you're seeing worlds within that. It's almost like fractal worlds. So when you narrow your focus that much, that something, some secret is revealed or something. Mm-hmm. And I found that all of his writings really, really inspiring. So he would be another one. Angela Carter, anything she wrote, I also loved. I loved her kind of, the kind of noble savagery of her work, you know, that things were never, you know, there's always a bit of, there's an underlying fear, you know, behind everything. It's sinister but beautiful. You're kind of transfixed by it, even though bad things happen, you know. You willingly walk in there, you know, prepared for the bad things to happen. I have to mention another one, Back to France, because again, I read this book when I was younger, probably read it far too early on. I read a story called Pierrot by Guy de Maupassant. And this is a story about a wee dog. Oh. A wee doggy who gets thrown into a well, in short, right? But gets thrown into a well because his owner is not able to look after him, and so just wants to get rid of him. But then she regrets having done it because, you know, she regrets having done it. So then she goes and throws food down to Pierrot to keep him alive, because she, you know, feels guilty. And so I read that when I was really quite young, and I was kind of horrified and fascinated by it. And then I read it when I was older, like a young adult, and it meant so much more. Or again, I went on a deeper level into it, this idea of the futility of Pierrot's existence. And I suppose that Maupassant possibly is saying to us, well, what was the point of this woman riddled by guilt maintaining this dog's life when it wasn't going to survive anyway? So, you know, what's the point in being kind, I suppose, or whatever. But that book meant, that story, it's not a book, that story meant a tremendous amount to me. And
oh, I love the themes in that. The guilt especially is very interesting to me.
Yeah.
I wonder, is it about feeding, you know, the indulgence of feeding your guilt, or like nurturing your regrets or something like that?
But she wasn't going to help, you know, like it's that whole dynamic of, and I get it, because, you know, if I was in her shoes, I'd be doing the same thing. I get it. But that dynamic, there's no right or wrong answer, you know, of whether she's riddled by guilt, and therefore to assuage her guilt, she's maintaining a status quo that is not good in the first place.
It's not helping anybody.
So it's just interesting.
I'm too invested in this dog. Now, Niamh, we said before we started that that any kind of animal in peril immediately has me invested and worried for the animal. Now I kind of really want to know, so I suppose she didn't try to get the dog out of the well. The story would not be working on any level if she got the dog out of the well. So
she can't. Yeah, the premise is she can't.
I
recommend you read the story. Read a translation of the story. It's really fantastic.
I will. So it's just called Pierrot.
Pierrot, yeah.
Did I do the R right there?
Yes, you did. Well done. My Parisian elderly lady would be so proud of you.
Thank you very much. It's funny because a lot of the books and themes and things that you've been talking about, I know they're quite general anyway, but a lot of it I can relate to. Again, I've just finished Four Nights Sea, so it's always very fresh in my mind. But, you know, you're talking about fractal worlds. You know, you're talking about like a slight sense of menace. I don't know, has anyone ever said that to you about your stories, that there is a sort of slight, to me, I found this sort of undercurrent of, maybe menace is the wrong word, uneasiness. Like uneasy, yeah, that would be the word, maybe.
Yeah, that has been mentioned, yes. But that's good, you know. I mean, I think that's my, you know, personally speaking, that's my constant state of existence is uneasy, right? A certain malaise, and I think that's fine, and that's what life is. No, that's not true to say. That's not what life is. But I suppose, you know, what would be the point really in writing stories where everything is neat and tidy and just reflective of conclusive.
Of course.
That's where the heat is for me. Where we're going to areas where it's uncertain. So it's not that it's decidedly sinister either. So that we've an uncertainty about, how am I supposed to take this? So me as a writer, I'm like, how am I supposed to write this? If it's really, really beautiful, then there's no point in writing this. If it's really sinister, it's already decidedly sinister, then also why am I writing this? So I go to where there's that ambiguity, and I try to be ruthless in my writing of it then, as in I try to be honest, I suppose, and not make it nicer or easier for the reader. But I do have to say in my defense that I do, because I believe this about life, I do tend to end my stories on a hopeful note. At least I think I do, that there's always some sense of either acceptance of the uneasy thing or a hopeful note that the uneasy thing is not as uneasy as we originally thought. I remember reading something, just dodging back to my childhood again, because it's something that really, really meant something to me. Reading a nature story, and I can't remember who wrote it or where I got the book. I think it was French again, but it was a story, and they were stories that were not fantastical stories. They were recountings of wildlife, but they were slightly fictionalized. So there was a particular story that stayed with me about a bird. You're not going to like this, Ruth.
I'm not going to like it.
but it's kind of like, okay, so there's a bird. She's incubating her eggs. And there's a mink, a hungry mink. And both are in the story, as I recall it. And I don't know where this book is now. I can't find it anywhere. But I thought I had it in my library, but I don't. So the mink is looking for sustenance, and the bird is following her instinct, you know, sitting on her eggs, waiting for them to hatch. And so he, in the end, I don't know why I'm saying he, the mink ends up finding the bird on the nest and killing the bird to eat the bird. And the act of the killing of the bird is written in a really slow and methodical way. So it's not written in any kind of grotesque or gory way. The death is slow also, because the mink just kind of latches onto the bird's neck and slowly sucks the blood out. So it's a slow dance of death. And it's, yeah, of course it is horrific. But I remember after reading that and being horrified and yet not being able to, not allowing myself to be too, and the author, I think, intended that I did not allow myself to be too horrified, because this mink was acting on instinct and needed to, you know, sustain itself. And the bird was acting on instinct by not flying away from the nest to avoid danger. And I just love that dynamic of what do you do in these situations, let's say, as an author, where you've got two competing, one of the aspect, one of the members of the dynamic has to give in to the other, let's say, for want of a better way to put it. So, and both have a right to that. And so who do you decide is going to come out on top? So that meant a lot to me back then and still means a lot to me when I'm drafting the stories, especially when we're talking about the animals and instinct and what happens. It's like, well, what would happen? Mm. What would happen in real life, I guess.
And that to me is what makes your stories so absolutely palpitating with life. I mean, they really are real. There's a, and for all their kind of surreality sometimes or abstractness, and there's a beautiful sort of poetry that kind of weaves in and lots of metaphor and interesting things like that. There is, you know, there is, yeah, there's a heart of honesty in there. And when I was saying unsettling, I meant it as a compliment. and I meant uneasy as a compliment, because I think it's so hard. I mean, it's so subtle, and yet it's just a sort of a tug, you know. And there's a lovely kind of, well, at times for me it was maybe too much apprehension about what was going to happen, particularly with creatures and animals. But as you say, usually there is a note of hope at the end. But yeah, there's a lovely kind of questioning for the reader, I think. Of there's an openness, I think, to the stories where you're kind of unsure in the best possible way, but you know, you feel confident in the writer. And I don't know how you do that. So congratulations again. Sorry, it's the middle of the podcast. I've already said congratulations, but sorry, off tangent there. Do you know what has just occurred to me is there when you were talking about the layers of animation, and you were talking about that slight wobble of, was it the second panel or something? And I think that's the wobble in your stories, is that kind of life's like that, isn't it? There's that sort of unsettling kind of, you know, the who knowsness of it.
Yeah, that's a good way to put it. Yes, the wobble. I like that. I can't add to that. I think you've actually contained it perfectly.
we'll leave the wobble there. Okay, I wonder, is there, well, I don't know, this is a facile question to ask, you know, after that sort of chat, but do you read books again and again? You do, because you've talked about Alice in Wonderland, you've talked about that story that you go back to. So there are things that you revisit then,
yes,
like at different points in your life that they mean different things to you. So a different question then, is there one book that stands out to you over the course of, like, I don't know, your adult life, and you think, okay, that book was there for me when I needed it, or that book was there for me when, you know, things were bad or things were great, or a particular moment in your life, you go, that's a special book for me?
I remember Wise Blood by Flannery O'Connor, which I have read again and again and again since I first read it. I read it first when I was in the States, so in my early 20s, late teens, early 20s. And for me, and I'm sure many people would have a different experience, but for me, it contained a gateway into understanding the American psyche. and this is such a fantastic, crazy story. The central character and all of the characters that work with him and his motivations and the kind of slapstick things that happen to him and the grotesque things that happen and that he's responsible for. All of this, every time I reread that story, I get something different from it. I get another little thing that I hadn't noticed the first time around, even just like details of the costume, the wardrobe, you know, Flannery O'Connor's depictions of what people are wearing, the settings. That's one book. Well, that's one writer in general who's writing. I go back to again and again because I always find new layers and new meaning. Other books, there is a book that I read a good few years ago, and I forget the name of the author, but the book was about the Wild Boy of Aveyron, which is a story recounting this child that was found in the forests of southern France in 1800. This wild child who, and nobody knows where he had come from. He was about, I think, 7 when he was found, and he had survived somehow in the forest because he had no English. He had no English in the first place. It was in France, but he had no language. He was an animal. He was an animal in that sense, that he was behaving as an animal. And I mean, notwithstanding that we're all animals to start with, but he was not part of any way, shape or form of any society and had no recollection or apparent recollection of any, you know, human society behavior. And that book is a book, Lane actually is the name of the author, something Lane. An American author. So he recounts the, it's not fiction, so he's recounting, it's historical, he's recounting the doctor that took in this young boy and tried then to teach him how to speak and teach him how to behave. And Victor, they called him Victor. And Victor then lived until, I think he lived until his mid-30s. I forget what he died of. But it's just fascinating to me to see, because it's a historical recounting. And to watch, because it's so revelatory in terms of how we behave as humans and what it is that distinguishes us from the animals. And it's very sad, of course. I want to reach out and hug this little boy. But little boy is a survivor. You know, he survived whatever way or whatever age he was abandoned in the forest. It was early enough that he had no language. And
the most fascinating part to me is the no language, yeah. Just what brings back what we were talking about earlier and the kind of the sort of miracle of speech anyway. But was he able to?
A very crude form of language he was able to pick up after a while, you know, like words, but never. He was never articulate, you know, and he learned more or less how to behave, but not really. He was always a little bit wild and unpredictable. And, of course, several times he bolted back to the forest, and had to be retrieved.
Can you remember sorry to interrupt you there. Can you remember what his relationship was like with other animals? Like how he communicated with like dogs or birds?
He was, of course, at peace with dogs especially. And so the thought is that he might have been raised by wolves. At least he wasn't torn apart by wolves. So therefore he clearly had some kind of, because the forest would have been teeming with wolves. And that would have been the first danger to him as a human child in there, defenseless. So they obviously decided to ignore him because he survived. So he did have an ability with animals that the others didn't, and maybe it was his positioning himself as one of them, as opposed to, you know, somebody that was you know. Higher at a higher plane. It was a fascinating story, a fascinating insight into our humanity, I guess. Oh, look at your doggy!
Sorry,
I love your doggy.
He had to be part of this conversation. Sorry, Niamh. Here he is. That's Bear.
Oh, I have seen Bear before. I've always thought he had a beautiful dog. I saw Bear on some of your social posts. I have four dogs here. I have four dogs. They're all sleeping around me.
Oh, very well behaved.
I was terrified then, thinking one of them's going to start barking, but so far they're all sleeking. And one of them is going to have puppies in about a week's time.
So my all looking goodness. Forward to that. Yeah. Oh, that is so exciting. Yeah. Oh, that is so exciting. Oh, my God. Bear is, I'm afraid, his
Bear is beautiful.
Yes, he is a beautiful boy, aren't you? Sorry to interrupt our conversation there, as we were talking to the animals. But yeah, I'm really interested in the kind of, I wonder, did he have, well, he must have had an affinity, and perhaps he was able to communicate in ways that the people around him didn't know or appreciate. Do you know what I mean? That he could communicate, and he was maybe silently communicating a different language, or through his body language, or through his pheromones or something. What's the title of the book? I've completely forgotten it now, of the boy in the forest.
It's called The Wild Boy of Aveyron. So it's Aveyron. The Wild Boy.
The Wild Boy of, I'm definitely going to look, that sounds absolutely up my street. It's fascinating. And sorry, when was he found in the forest? What year?
1800. Yeah, so this is from the 1800, this as in the story.
Ah, okay. So that makes
this book by Lane was written in the 70s, I believe. An American author. But there's many other books written on this. So in fact, if you look up The Wild Boy of Aveyron, you'll find many other books probably written on him. But the one that I read was Lane's book. And absolutely fascinating.
That's fascinating. It's how we would be. It's how we would be without language, which is, that's fascinating. Oh, thanks for that. That's a great recommendation. Now, two difficult questions. One is a book of yours, published or unpublished, or a short story of yours, perhaps, published or unpublished, that you would save above all the rest if your house was on fire? Only one.
I only have one book. I will save my Four Night Seas. That's the book. I've been publishing in many different journals, like individual stories or poems, but the only book that I have is Four Night Seas. So I have to save Four Night Seas. So if I'm not, if that's not allowed, if I have to choose a story from Four Night Seas, what would I choose? Well, that's difficult because I love them all, genuinely do, and have a sort of a relationship with each one of them. Maybe I would choose the central one, the story that's called Four Night Seas. It's actually at the very, very center of the book in itself, which was a happy chance. I wanted to place it in the middle of the book, but so that wasn't chance. That was planning. But when I was looking at it later, because I'm very interested in structure, and I was looking at the book, I saw that the Four Night Seas story and the middle of the Four Night Seas story actually falls right in the middle of the book as far as page count is concerned, which is weird. But that story, which contains four different retellings, four different tellings of an event that happens in the sea at night, and each telling is different from the one before, kind of contradicts the one before. Each new telling is from a different point of view and written in a different tense and slightly different tone and with a different slightly different outcomes, you know, even though the outcome is ambiguous. And then the final section, so there's four night seas, there's four tellings, and then the final section is the author herself, who comes up and sort of waves a flag saying, well, I'm here too. This is what I've been trying to do. This is what I've been trying and failing to do. So she also makes an appearance and on the page saying what, you know, what she's been trying to do and why she's been trying to do it and admitting defeat at the end of it. So she talks about tapetum lucidum, which is in each of the stories, which is that, for want of a better word, thing that happens at the back of the eye in animals. In some animals, they have that iridescent lining at the back of their eye. So if you're driving along a road at night and you see a badger or you see the two eyes or a fox or a dog or a cat, that's called tapetum lucidum. And so the author says, well, I'm trying to tell this story through using, for instance, the motif of tapetum lucidum. And so I outline what I'm doing and yet I'm not really, I don't really make any sense. And that was purposely done. So I like that story because I think it captures my attitude to writing in the first place. This thing about, I do like, you know, that people notice that it's a story and that I don't want to hypnotize people and make them really believe that this is an actual world. I like the idea that I'm reminding them this is just a story. Mm-hmm. I like that, kind of playing with that. And I like I'm hoping that even though as we're reading through it, we're realizing, well, these are just stories and each one is different than the last one. I'm hoping that as a reader, you still want to get to the end, even though that fourth wall has been broken by the author. And so, now that you're asking me, though I feel really guilty to all my other story babies, but now that you're asking me, I think that would be the story that I would save.
Oh, we're definitely keeping it. It's a beautiful, beautiful, beautifully crafted story. Okay, I was going to ask you about a book you would leave in your house to burn, Niamh, but I don't know if you're willing to do that.
There's a host of books. They all go under the one label. Because I'm looking at them right now. They're just behind my laptop on a bunch of shelves because I'm sitting in my kind of kitchen area. And so a bunch of bookshelves just behind the laptop here that I'm looking directly at now is full of recipe books, cookbooks. There's three shelves of cookbooks and I would burn them all. I would let them all perish in the flames because they make me feel so guilty because I never open them. And, you know, sometimes in the past when I have opened them, they all look so beautiful and beautiful people cooking beautiful things. And I'm like, oh my God, I can never be that. So there's this reminder to me about, because I'm fairly rudimentary in the kitchen. So I'm fairly rudimentary in person, full stop. So yes, they can all go. The recipe books can all go.
Gone. All of them are gone. Nigella Lawson, Jamie Oliver,
Dorina Allen, all those beautiful people that, you know, yeah.
Gone. Brilliant. Okay, they're burning. Now, in a little second, you're going to read for us from Four Nightsies. So which story have you chosen to read from, Niamh?
I think I'm going to read the section at the end of Sea Eagle Sonata. So Sea Eagle Sonata is a story that's written in three parts. There are three, I suppose, central characters. So the first character is a baker in his cafe. And then the second character is his client that he, you know, in section one, the baker is talking to his client, his customer, not client, his customer, who's in drinking coffee in the early morning, or tea, actually. And the second section is that customer, that young boy, who actually appears in other stories in the collection. So that young man, he's not a boy, he's a young man at this point. He, in section two of Seagull Sonata, this young man takes off and heads nonstop, doesn't stop traveling until he reaches the Isle of Skye. And then the third section. So in the Isle of Skye, this young man crosses the path of a sea eagle. And in the third section, we have the sea eagle speaking. Well, she's not speaking, but it is from her point of view, in as much as I could. Because one of the things that I found really challenging, that I loved the challenge of in all of these stories, is how do you narrate an animal's experience without becoming Bambi, but also without being afraid of trying to inhabit that animal? So I always try to be really, really wide awake when I'm doing that. So I am in the sea eagle's point of view. She's with her mate, but it's her. And so this is what she sees and this is what she, not what she thinks. I don't go that far. I don't try and figure out what she thinks, but this is what, at least what she sees and what she feels. She soars on a thermal, talons tucked into her body. Her mate is behind, calling. The sleek finger feathers at either end of her dark wingspan flicker upward in the soft wind. The Atlantic glisters below. She twists her head, eyes her mate. Extending his talons in play, his white tail fans out to slow his flight. He beats his broad wings twice, then glides once more. She folds one wing into herself, turning back swiftly to him. Meeting, they interlock talons and cartwheel downward together through the air. Wings lashing against the spin, their pale yellow eyes are fixed, sea and sky tumbling behind them. Swooping apart just as they're about to hit water, their feathers skim the surface. After four shallow wing beats over the waves, they tilt back towards each other. He rolls under, touching his talons to hers before scudding upwards. She follows, calling. The cliff face looms. Their enduring eyrie of heather, juniper and driftwood nestles in a hollow there, shreds of seaweed and moss lining the inside. She spots motion on the headland, banks sharp towards it. Sunlight is catching thin ribbons carried swirling on the wind. She draws nearer, focuses on a man, releasing shiny, inanimate strips into the air. Her eye follows the slivers of tin, determining their composition. Disinterested, she beats her wings to rise and steadies onto a thermal once more. Her mate follows, silent. Returning her gaze to the lone man, she watches him flick a small shape from him. Its folded purple manifests to her as a multitude of vivid shades, an alluring spectrum of amethysts and sapphires. Half closing one wing, she dives down towards the falling form. When close to her mark, she establishes its inertness, but is driven to catch it in her beak before twisting away upward. Her tongue probes the sugary, pleated paper. Rolling her eye back under its bony brow ridge to the man exposed on the headland above their eyrie, she watches him staring up at her, his mouth dropping open. He stands, and a tangle of black, white, and gold falls lifeless at his feet. He cries out to her, slowly extends his arms wide, yielding his bare throat, calling, benevolent, his body open, harmless. Her waiting mate signals caution. She swings back up towards his open-winged silhouette, hovering dark before the sun. Circling around him, she listens to the fading serenade from the prone man below, then pirouettes skyward, the sea air lifting her wings.
You've been listening to author Niamh McCabe, whose short story collection, Four Night Seas, is out now with the Lilliput Press. See you all next time.